Welcome to another Islam in Focus program. I'd like to begin today's program by greeting you with our usual greeting, Assalamu Alaikum, which means peace be unto you. Today we're starting a very new series. We'll be talking about this new series, we'll be dealing with the political system of Islam. Our first program in this new series, we'll deal with religion in the state. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid, and I have joining me on the program as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, Assalamu Alaikum.
Wa Alaikum Assalam.
Before we get into this new series, our ninth series, I wonder if I could ask you to explain the connection between this new series we're about to embark upon and the previous eight series that we've dealt with so far.
Okay. Well, the first four series in this program dealt mainly with the articles of faith, questions pertaining to belief, including the one on monotheism or oneness of God, one on the prophethood, the third one was on Muhammad in the Bible, which was like a sort of branching on the topic of prophethood, the fourth was on Muslim belief. So all four first series, which is almost a total of 40 programs, I believe, dealt mainly with the matter of faith. The fifth series, however, dealt with the basic devotional acts of worship, or the so-called remaining four pillars of Islam. You see, the first four series are more or less like the first pillar of Islam, question of belief, and the fifth series dealt with the four other pillars of Islam, you know, fasting,
yes,
prayer, fasting, charity, and pilgrimage. The sixth series, however, which was quite a lengthy one, dealt with the moral teachings of Islam,
yes,
which covered a wide variety of topics, all the way from the philosophical or conceptual aspects, the basic questions of ethics, to the questions of lawful and unlawful in Islam, pertaining to the behavior of the individual in various aspects of life, all the way to the last 10 programs in that series that dealt with the basic moral virtues. However, beginning from the seventh series, we went beyond beliefs or acts of worship or moral teaching to examine Islam as a complete way of life by examining some of the basic aspects as to how it organizes society. So the seventh series dealt with the social system in Islam. That was also quite a lengthy one, dealing with issues like the position of woman and her role and contribution in an ideal Islamic society, the question of engagement, marriage, marital relationships, dissolution of marriage, the question of rights of parents and relatives, and so on. The eighth series dealt with the economic system of Islam, dealing with questions of consumption, production and productivity, distribution, social justice, government policy in the economy. So this ninth series really is just like a continuation in the of the examination of the basic systems in Islam, dealing with the political part of it. So it's like just a more another building block, really, in giving a total picture of what Islam is all about.
Well, now, most of our viewers of the program, I would suspect, when you think of religion in the state, there's here in North America particularly, there's clear cut distinction and separation between religion and the state. Could you comment on that? What's your view of that?
You see, the separation between so-called religion and state, or what is secular and what is religious or sacred, in the West is something that has its own historical roots. Basically, it has something to do with the way the church was perceived by the people, and the way the relationship between the church and state was perceived. for quite a considerable period of time, the populace, the people, the masses, used to consider or perceive of the church as an institution which at times aligned itself with the ruling elite in a way that not necessarily served the interest of the masses. It was perceived by some people, especially in the 17th century on, as an institution which has a strong desire for power, struggling at all times with the ruling elite or so-called temporal authorities. Many people also seem to consider or have the name of the church somewhat synonymous with the Inquisition, courts, with the persecution of scientists and learning, and standing against free thinking and all that. And I'm just talking about how things were seen by the masses. Now, when the age of the so-called Enlightenment came, people reacted again in a very strong way, going to the other extreme, perhaps, by rejecting anything pertaining to the church or church power. And even those who even took a moderate position and were less critical of the church, quote-unquote, thought that the best way really is to separate the two functions, to keep the church devoted entirely to the spiritual and moral aspects of life, and leaving the temporal authority or secular authority in the hands of other people. This can be understood in terms of the circumstances surrounding the rise of the church and its history in the Christian world. But this does not mean that this principle of separation is either universal or that it has to be imposed on Islam. Islam has its own system. This whole notion of separation doesn't really apply in the case of Islam. It may have applied in the case of the West. Maybe justifiably so, I don't know. But I'm simply saying that in Islam it doesn't apply.
Well, let's take a look at this question now as it relates to Islam. Why doesn't the principle apply? Why isn't there this distinction, the separation of religion and state in Islam?
Well, to start with, in Islam there is no church as such. Of course, I'm not talking about a church here in terms of a building. Of course, in Islam also there are also buildings or mosques for prayers, but I'm talking about church the way it's understood in the Christian world or Western world in general, as an institution which has the exclusive power or authority to interpret matters of faith. Because of the same reason also we find that Islam doesn't have any system of priesthood or clergy or even ordination, to ordain people in certain particular ritualistic ways so that they can be priests. In Islam also the notion of saying that this is a man of the world and this is a man of religion does not exist. Ideally in Islam, every man or woman, every person is a man of religion or a person of religion. Every person has a certain responsibility to perform. It's not something that has to be invested only or entrusted to a certain class or a group of people and consider them to be the exclusive body who can speak on matters of faith. From the historical standpoint, we find that in Islam, we don't see in any noticeable degree at all anything that comes close to the notion of the Inquisition courts or persecution of scientists. And we have seen in the previous series on economic system of Islam how scientists were persecuted elsewhere, found security and encouragement and a good atmosphere for scientific productivity in the Muslim world. So the notion did not really exist in Islam. There was no such conflict or contradiction. Indeed, if there were any persecution in Islam, in Islamic history, or Muslim history to be more accurate, at times it was persecution not by the religious or people who are religious scholars of the masses, but it was persecution of those free thinkers among religious scholars by the ruling elite who sought to get justification and stamp of approval for their actions. So it was actually the reverse. It was not them that they were persecuting people. They were the ones who were persecuted by tyrannical or unjust rulers. And furthermore, conceptually speaking, the notion of religion, quote-unquote, in Islam is quite different from the way it is perceived in the West or in the Christian world in general.
Could you perhaps explain that for us, that is, you know, the notion of religion, how it differs with the Muslim as opposed to the common conception?
Well, taking the common reaction of a common person, if you ask someone what is religion, in the Western sense, people would typically say that it is the you know, set of beliefs or values which deal with the spiritual or moral aspects of life. This is how it's restricted, mostly rites and certain aspects of belief, being good and so on. In Islam, the word religion itself means way of life and way of or living. And way of living includes all aspects of life, be it spiritual, moral, social, economic, or even political. These are all part of Muslim understanding of what religion is. As indicated in some previous programs, especially on the moral teaching of Islam, Islam takes the human being as he or she is, not just looking at one aspect of our existence.
Mm-hmm.
It takes the human being as a spiritual being and tries to satisfy those needs. It takes the human being as an intellectual being and respect human intelligence and human reasoning and use that as a tool for faith rather than the opposite or antithesis of faith. It takes the human being even as a physical being, looking after his or her needs in all respects, which may include economic aspects, political aspects, you name it. So there is a whole notion of integrity or integration of all aspects of life in one harmonious whole. Now, the notion of shirk in Islam, for example, that might clarify this mm-hmm. integration of various aspects. In Islam, shirk, which means unbelief or associating others with God in his powers, does not limit itself only to believing in more than one God or that some individuals or creatures of God share any of the divine attributes of God. In fact, in Islam, this act, which is very much condemned, of shirk, involves recognition of any authority as the highest or ultimate authority in place of or alongside with the authority of God, that the authority of God is the one that should really be supreme. And I believe that this has been basically the call and the teaching of all of prophets in the past. It's not something really that should be regarded as a total innovation of Islam. But we're simply saying that people might have misinterpreted the mission of the prophets to mean only exclusively the spiritual or moral part. All prophets taught this basic notion in some way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, if we accept what you say, that all of the prophets brought a common message, how would you respond to someone who might suggest, well, Prophet Jesus, peace and blessings be upon him, was quoted as saying that you should render unto Caesar what is Caesar, and render unto God that which is God. That which is God.
It's kind of a common...
Mm-hmm.
All right. First of all, just by way of reservation, even if we assume that Jesus, peace be upon him, did actually say that, I'm not even getting into whether he said it or not, but even if we assume for the sake of understanding that he said that, my humble understanding as a Muslim, that he didn't really mean by that what is commonly put into his words.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back to this particular quotation and read the context, you'll notice that some people came with a kind of evil intention
mm-hmm.
of trapping Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him. You see, they were trying to prove to the Roman authorities that this man is defying their authorities and he's, you know, he should be punished for that or, you know, getting rid of. And one way of trying to reach their objective is that they came to him and wanted to extract from him a statement that could be interpreted as defiance of the Roman authorities. So they came to say, should we pay the taxes to the authorities, to the government? See, now, Jesus, Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, in my humble understanding, was smart enough and guided by God, by inspiration, to understand the evil intention behind this apparently innocent type of question. So he said, all right, render unto Caesar what is Caesar, and render unto God what is God. But he never really meant, in our understanding, that there are two authorities in this universe. Part of the authority is under the domain of God, and limited and restricted to church or good behavior and so on. And the other part belongs to temporal authorities, Roman rulers or otherwise. Because that contradicts the very basic notion of the supremacy of God. So this is a sort of, not giving a chance for his enemies to extract from him what they really wanted. But furthermore, one can also refer to the fact that the nature of the mission of Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, at least as explained in the Quran, was that he did not come with a complete law. Actually, he is quoted in the Gospels, as you know, I came not to destroy the law or prophets, I came to fulfill. So his mission was not really to come up with a new set of laws and regulations, but rather to add some spirituality to the formalistic practice of religion that existed among the Israelites of his time. And as the Quran indicates, his mission was a transitory one. It was a mission for a certain period of time until the last prophet, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, comes with spelling out through a revelation given to him the complete and more explicit way of living, which includes also spiritual as well as legal aspects of life. But given his circumstances and the nature of his mission, the scope of his mission, it wasn't necessary at his time to keep talking about in detail and explicitly about the relationship with the temporal authority. He wanted really people first to be uplifted in the spiritual sense. But as I said earlier, the notion of separation of what is religious and what is secular or what is temporal is something which is alien not only to Islam, but it's alien even to the notion of essence, or the essence of all revelation given to all of the prophets, because it does contradict the notion of servitude to God, or Allah, to God alone.
Mm-hmm. Well, the notion of servitude to God, I wonder if perhaps I could get you to elaborate a little bit on this notion and how it relates to the political system in your opinion.
Well, the Quran indicates that one of the greatest problems, biggest problems of humanity, has not really been whether or not to believe in God. It's not whether or not to admit and recognize that God is the creator, but rather the failure to carry this belief to its logical conclusion and to be true servants of God and to really submit to the will of God. Let me give you a few examples of this. In the chapter 23 in the Quran, from verse 84 on, it speaks about questions that if directed to unbelievers, they would respond in the affirmative. It says, for example, that when you ask them who or unto whom belongs the earth and what is over the earth, the answer comes in the Quran, they will say it belongs to God. Unto whom belongs the heavens and what is therein? They will say it belongs to God. Unto whom is the possession or sovereignty over all creation? They will say it belongs to Allah or to God. In a way, they admit that everything belongs to God, but they rebel. They don't want to comply with what that creator, the one and only creator of the universe, commands them to do. In a similar way, for example, in chapter 43 in the Quran, verse 86 on, it says again, when you ask them, who created you? They will say, God or Allah. Well, again, they stop at that. If you admit that God is your creator, then it follows logically that you should follow what that creator tells you to do. See, he knows best what is good for you, so you should follow him. But they stop at just that vision that God created them. By the same, in the same vein also, in chapter 29, for example, in the Quran, in verses 61 on, it talks also about asking those people, who created the heavens and earth? They would say, God. Who made subservient to you the sun and the moon? They will say, God. Who brought forth water, brought down water from the skies so that it would provide you with the, you know, badly needed source of, you know, agriculture and vegetation and so on? They again will admit it is God. But again, they stopped at this point. So what we're saying basically is that the problems of humanity, both in the past and present, is not the admission of the supremacy of God in terms of being the creator, but rather the human pride, vanity, and the refusal to accept his guidance, his command, his directions as to how we conduct our lives.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there explicit evidence in the Quran that the establishment of an Islamic system of government is mandatory?
That it's part of the implementation of the faith?
Yes.
Well, there are numerous evidence for that. Let me give you just, you know, some samples of what the Quran says about it. In chapter 3 in the Quran, in verse 154, it says, قُلْ إِنَّ الْأَمْرَ كُلَّهُ لِلَّهِ. It say, O Muhammad, unto people, that all matters or affairs are holy God's. More explicitly even, in chapter 6 in the Quran, verse 54, speaking about God, it says, أَلَا لَهُ الْخَلْقُ وَالْأَمْرُ. That is, it is, or is it not, it's put it in the form of a question, is it not His, that is God's, to create and govern? And that's an interesting expression there, الْخَلْقُ وَالْأَمْرُ, creation and governing. Because again, as we were explaining in the previous question, some people's problem is that they stop at the creation. They say, all right, we admit that God is the creator. But when it comes to God's right as a creator, or as the creator, to govern, to tell us what to do, that's separate. So this beautiful and very concise verse put them both together. That if you admit that God is the creator, then you have to admit also that He's the one who should govern. And governing here does not mean simply governing the universe in terms of physical phenomena, but also moral laws, social laws, political laws, economic laws. These are all ultimately, in terms of basic principles, basic directives, are the authority and the domain of God. In a similar way, and that's an interesting quotation also in the Quran, in chapter 43, verse 84, وَهُوَ الَّذِي فِي السَّمَاءِ إِلَهٌ وَفِي الْأَرْضِ. It says, it is He, that is God, or Allah, who is Lord in heavens and Lord on earth. In other words, it's not like some people think that, you know, the domain of God is the spiritual things, because God is so busy to worry about our worldly affairs. As God is Lord in heavens, as the spiritual part should be directed and dedicated to Him of our lives, so should also be our earthly life. And what is our earthly life? It's not all just prayers and supplications or rites. Earthly life includes economics as much as it includes social as well as political. So that's a clear indication also as to what the orientation of Islam is. In two quotations in the Quran uses basically the same expression, that is in chapter 6 verse 57 and chapter 12 verse 40. إِنِ الْحُكْمُ إِلَّا لِلَّهِ, which means that the command rests with none, or is for none, but Allah, or God. But beyond this, you might say, broader type of citations from the Quran that shows, again, the question of servitude and the acceptance of directives of God, the Quran also, in one section, very interesting section, describes those who refuse to rule or judge in accordance to what God has revealed as unbelievers, wrongdoers, and rebels against God. In chapter 5, verses 47-53, it says, وَمَنْ لَمْ يَحْكُمْ بِمَا أَنْزَلَ اللَّهُ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْكَافِرُونَ. Those who do not rule according to what God has revealed, they are unbelievers. and then it goes on, describe certain things, and then end the verse, the following verse, that whoever does not rule or judge in accordance with what Allah has revealed, these are wrongdoers. And later on, again, it says they are rebels against that. So if a person ruling, being in a position of governor or president or whatever, does not comply with these rules, then all these three descriptions apply to him. But interesting enough, the same section also, after describing this, directs its message to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, telling him, as in verse 51, وَأَنْ يَحْكُمْ بَيْنَهُمْ بِمَا أَنْزَلَ اللَّهِ, and rule among them, O Muhammad, judge between them according to what Allah has sent down in terms of revelation, in terms of directives. So even the Prophet himself was directed to implement the law of God, not to take his role only as just preaching and make sermons, but also to carry out the implementation of those rules. This section ends by reminding people or asking them in a way that really would arouse their attention. It says, أَفَحُكْمَ الْجَاهِلِيَةِ يَغُونَ, are those people seeking the judgment of the days of ignorance or un-Islamic ways in judging between their affairs? And then it says, and who is better or what is better than the judgment or rule of God? In other words, the and these are only sentences. The Quran is full of indications, direct, indirect, implicit, and many times explicit, that shows without any shred of doubt that the establishment of Islamic order, the establishment of Islamic rule, is mandatory. It's a requirement that the Muslims as a group and individuals, whenever they are able to, must establish. But it's not only the Quran that provides this evidence. We find that also in the prophetic tradition, in the saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, many times he speaks about having an emir or having a leader. In one case, even he says, if even three people are traveling, they should choose one of them as their heads or their leaders. How about if you have even a whole state? There's no doubt, historically speaking, that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, did not only act as a prophet in the common notion understood by most people, but he was also a statesman. He was a head of a state. He did conduct the affairs of Muslims. He did establish the mechanism that looked after the implementation of those rules. In fact, many times when you look into the Quran and the way it addresses believers, you will notice that it addresses them in the plural. Even in matters of prayer, not only politics or social life, even in matters of prayers, it addresses people in plural, showing the collective orientation. Of course, collective without suppressing individuality, but at least it shows that you have to act together as a community of believers to implement the will of God. And furthermore, let me give you one more evidence that I think would be relevant to this particular question. Many times the Quran speaks, for example, about certain rules or aspects of criminal law, if you will. How could this be implemented? Can any person just take the law in his hand or her hand and go on and implement those rules? It's impossible. So the very fact that these rules are mentioned in the Quran shows of necessity that there must be some organized state, some leadership that makes sure that the laws would be implemented in a fair and impartial way. So the evidence is quite overwhelming to the effect that you cannot separate religion from the state in Islam. It's a totally alien idea. It has nothing to do with Islam at all.
Well, on that note, I think we will conclude our program for today. We want to thank you for watching and invite you back next week, and we'll continue with our second program in our new series dealing with the political system of Islam. We'll be looking at the nature of the political system in Islam. Thank you for watching. As-salamu alaykum. Peace be unto you.
Allah is the one who 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 is the one